Hello and welcome to a special edition of the Slate Political Gabfest for November 7th, 2020, the Biden Wins edition. I am David Plotz of CityCast. My windows are open, so in the background you may hear the celebratory horn honking along Connecticut Avenue here in Washington, D.C. That's part of the texture of this show, I think, for today. I'm joined from New Haven, from her home, by Emily Bazelon of the New York Times Magazine and Yale University Law School. Hello, Emily.
Hello, David.
And from Manhattan, New York City, of 60 Minutes on CBS, John Dickerson. Hello, John.
Hello, David. Hello, Emily.
It is a mark of how unusual this episode is that John is in a t-shirt. Never has that happened before. Before we get started, I just want to thank our Slate Plus members for supporting us through this. It's allowing us to do some of these extra episodes. So thank you, dear Slate Plus members. Go to slate.com/GabFestPlus if you want to become a Slate Plus member. Although this whole episode is for everybody. So as we are taping on Saturday afternoon, yes, it's Saturday afternoon, Joe Biden has won the presidential election. The television networks, newspapers, and global leaders have concluded that he is going to win by dint of having won the states of Pennsylvania, Nevada, and possibly Arizona and Georgia, but it was Pennsylvania that cemented it for most of these folks who made a call. John, you've been deep in one of these newsrooms for days and days and days. What took so long, and was that good that it took so long?
Yeah, I think it was good. I mean, if you believe what my reporting tells me, which is sometimes, you know, sometimes that's true, sometimes the reporting takes you the wrong way. The elections officials were being incredibly methodical. They were dealing with, obviously, voting in COVID times, and then also dealing just with the sheer number of ballots coming in. And they were being methodical. They always told us that slowness was a good thing because it meant they were measuring twice and cutting once. What happened to us is, what day is it, Saturday? On Friday, we went in, we saw the trajectory of votes coming in from around Pittsburgh and Philadelphia were going towards Joe Biden, more heavily in Philadelphia than around Pittsburgh, but nevertheless, heavily going towards him. The trajectory was there. He overtook President Trump. And what the worry was is it started to kind of level off. He was still winning, but not by the big margins. Then it turned out they announced they had all these provisional ballots. So what happened was it was like a racetrack where the horses are running and then suddenly you don't know the length of the track. So you knew the one horse was ahead and you knew he was continuing to be ahead, but you didn't know the length of the track. And that's what slowed things down. And that broke through on Saturday morning. And also Biden in Pennsylvania, which was the key to sending him over, had enough of a lead, which as we're taping is at about 37.5. That's over the recount number. And so if you're going to declare that he's won the presidency, you want to have done it in states where he doesn't have a recount.
Emily, Biden has been declared the president-elect. Is there any ambiguity about this?
No, there is no ambiguity about it because it's a victory that involves so many different states. There are a bunch of states that are close, but there are a bunch of states in the end that will probably put him over the top. So on Saturday, the news organizations called Nevada for him, as well as Pennsylvania, and Arizona is out there, I think, will probably get called soon. And he'll probably win Georgia, too, in the end. And so what you're going to see here is an actual virtue of the Electoral College, which is that it disperses power and it disperses accountability. And because we're going to have multiple states' voting systems in play, it will not be an outcome that it will be disturbed. It's going to hold.
Why do you think, Emily, that this electoral system, which is so messed up in so many ways, so problematic in so many ways, so troubled in so many ways, acquitted itself so well during this? Is it that there was just such a sense of alert? There were so many warnings. There was so much sense that we have to do well that it acquitted itself so well? Because my sense is that, man, these folks did their job. They did it thoughtfully and well and carefully. And as a result, it's not that people will not question the outcome, because if we already see that President Trump's supporters are full of doubts and are casting aspersions upon it. But I think as a fairly neutral observer, people will say this was done well and fairly, despite the vagaries and weirdness of the Electoral College.
Yeah, it's kind of a miracle, honestly. I mean, I've been following this pretty closely since the spring when coronavirus hit the United States, and it became clear this was going to be an election like no other, and that states that had never had any kind of vote by mail operation on scale, right? Everybody had a little bit of absentee balloting, but they'd never done it to scale, that they were going to have to super ramp up that part of voting while they simultaneously continued to give people an opportunity to vote at the polls. And there were some primaries that went really badly, especially in Wisconsin, but also in New York. Pennsylvania wasn't so great either. And I think in some ways, those dress rehearsals really did help make everybody aware how much was at stake, how much could go wrong. And then I think you also see, and I mean, I find this quite moving, this is a part of the government where it's not particularly partisan. Like, people are doing their jobs. The Office of Secretary of State, which in most states really oversees the electoral systems that is then decentralized in a lot of different counties, it's just not a hyper-political office. And so outside of a couple exceptions, like particularly in Texas, what you saw were people just like getting it together to do this work. And I was struck this week, Philadelphia's electoral, you know, the actual administration is controlled by a 3-member commission. It has a Republican on it. He was out there sticking up for Philadelphia's vote counting as President Trump and his people were trashing it. And so I think this is one place where we still have some bipartisan flickers, and that has really made a difference.
It was amazing, Emily, to see the secretaries of state and these local election officials armed with the facts and also having been methodical, not just in their vote counting, but in the practices leading upward, basically taking all these hot takes that were coming at them and just bashing them to the side with, you know, just facts, unspinnable, straight up facts.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th only on Hulu. We started the show sort of talking about some of these logistics and actually like how the media called it. I actually want to pause. This is a really moving day here where I am in Washington, and I don't think it's not a secret to probably GabFest listeners. I am pleased that Donald Trump has lost this election. He, I think, has been an absolutely appalling president and an appalling presence in American life, and has caused inordinate, remarkable, massive amounts of damage, and he still will be president for several more months, and I hope he, you know...
Not several, two.
Two more months, 2.5 more months. And he has the capacity to do more things. And but as a person, as a human being, I'm very pleased that Joe Biden has won. And I am very moved, like, by what's happening where I live in Washington. I went down this morning to the White House, in front of the White House. You can't get anywhere near the White House because in part because of what's happened with this president. And the crowds of people there, the joy, the excitement, the kind of sense of... It is different than it was, I think, when President Obama won, when I was also in Washington. And for the Obama inauguration, there was this great sense of possibility. And I don't think that's what is there. But there's an enormous sense of relief. And I like want to bathe in that relief. And it doesn't change some of the deeply problematic dynamics that this country has. And some of the divisions are sharp and deep and... They are not gone. They've not gone away at all. And it's not clear that President Biden will have the capacity to do as many things as his supporters hope. But just I feel a really profound sense of relief and gratitude toward the hard work that the people who work to defeat President Trump displayed. And you guys don't need to comment. You both work for news organizations and you don't have a partisan position. But I feel less constrained. The celebrations are really moving. I don't know if you guys got a chance to see them, but they're not like anything I have seen ever in this country. And not even like when sports teams win, like when the Nationals win, when the Washington football team won the Super Bowl, not at all like this. It is amazing what's happening in Washington right now.
In New York, when we were on the air Saturday morning, showing pictures of celebrations in Washington, you could hear the celebration. We were in the middle of a building in Times Square, and you could hear the celebrations in Times Square coming through the walls. It was so loud and boisterous. Anne reports that walking down the street in the city of New York, people were just bursting into tears as they saw strangers in the streets in response to the news.
And, you know, some of it is partisan and is about the end of President Trump's presidency. And part of it is about relief for the democracy and a kind of celebration of the process and the sense that, like, voting happened and it held and we are going to have a peaceful transfer of power. And from now on, whatever President Trump says about it is essentially a sideshow.
Actually, John, let's jump into that, which is we can talk a little bit about President Trump's legal challenges, which remain operational, I guess. But I'm interested in your sense about what President-elect Biden will do to try to unify the country or try to speak to the country. And more importantly, how you think this Trump administration will handle a transition.
Well, I don't know. I mean, they're legally obligated to have started the transition, which they have. And then there are different stages of what they must participate in to ensure a transition that makes sense. And you know, President Trump didn't ensure the transition that led up to his own office. So you have to think of have a pretty dismal view of the way things might go. But they are obligated. They are obligated to basically train up the Biden team. And that's all, that work has already started before the voting took place. I think one of the fascinating things that we will see, and as somebody who spent many months writing chapters about transitions and management and the difficulty of starting a White House, is that you will have somebody who's been in Washington for their entire career and knows how Washington operates, obviously not how it's operated over the last 4 years, but the theory of American government, and will have people around him who've either worked for him or worked in politics since the Clinton administration. Now, that is not a guarantee of wonderful outcomes and constant rainbows and unicorns. But what it means is two things. One is a matter of history. It's the most experienced Washington-experienced presidency we've had, I guess, since Johnson, in terms of the president and then the people around him. But then it also just means people who believe in the process of government and believe in reason and science and all of that. So that's the biggest thing coming back into the government that we haven't seen for 4 years.
You mentioned, of course, that the Trump team has cooperated and is doing its obligatory transition. It started it before the voting, as you say. Have you heard anything about whether this is going okay?
Yeah, I think it's going okay. One of the things that everybody should be happy about is the person who is in the Trump administration is Chris Liddell, who worked on the Romney transition that never came to pass, but who kind of has a specialty in this, is in the Trump administration and is working on this, as I understand it. He doesn't talk to reporters, as far as I know. He doesn't talk to me. But as I understand it, is working very hard on the transition. Again, this is supposed to start before you even know who wins the election. And there's also the Partnership for Public Service, which has been working hard over the years to try to make transitions better and has been working with the Trump administration and the Biden folks. So it's not there are a lot of people who care about the continuation of government who are involved in this. And so they're kind of the equivalent of the people we were just talking about, the people who are involved in the counting of votes, who care about how they do their job. And so a lot of those people are involved in transition planning. So that should give people some hope. The fact that the chief of staff of the White House, Mark Meadows, is now diagnosed with COVID means that the really high level meetings are going to have to be delayed a little bit. And that's not great.
Not by Mark Meadows. Mark Meadows seems perfectly happy to show up. He'll show up unmasked at those meetings. Emily, we shouldn't forget the fact that President Trump at the moment certainly does not accept that he's been defeated and has signaled, or his people have signaled, there will be legal challenges. Any legal challenges that anyone should keep an eye out on?
I don't think so, not really. I mean, look, the thing about overturning the results of an election is that you have to have evidence of fraud. And there are a lot of accusations of fraud being made, but they are just like falling apart, vanishing in the air when they actually see the light of a courtroom. And so, you know, the notion that there is going to be some way to overturn these results, which are going to be out of recount range in enough states to provide a majority in the Electoral College, I just don't see it. Here's my theory. I wonder what you guys think about this. My theory for what's going on right now, I mean, first of all, like, President Trump is the kind of person, because he's such a narcissist, that it would take him a while to get used to this idea and admit it. But I wonder if also what he's doing is giving himself away that for the rest of his life, people who want to kowtow to him can say, oh, they cheated you out of this. Like, you had it. And there can be a kind of pretend coddling of him in his inner circle. And maybe, like, in his media future, a way of pretending that he didn't really lose, and that's what this is. It's show. It's not real litigation. It's not a real threat to not step down. It's just show.
It's therapy.
Yeah, it's yes. Like, there's so many things that have happened during this Trump presidency, which is, I mean, it's emperor's new clothes, but where they do things just to clearly to salve him, it's sycophantic, but it's also, as John, you say, therapeutic. But I remember there was some point where they ran a bunch of TV ads in Washington. They must have spent, you know, $1 million of campaign funds just so Trump could see them, even though it's a terrible place to run TV ads. There's so much that was done for the emperor to feel better about himself. Emily, are you saying that they will put up these challenges, they'll lose the challenges? Are you saying they won't put up the challenges? And they'll always be able to say, like, well, we could have challenged it and just, we just chose not to.
I mean, I don't know. Like, either way, there'll be some lawyer who's willing to take money to put up some challenge. And, you know, they
won't
have,
get paid. Trump doesn't pay his lawyers.
That could be a problem. Look, David Bossi is supposed to be in charge of the strategy. They'll look at what they can, and who knows how far they'll go. But the notion that there's some Hail Mary pass in the courts, like, it's just not going to happen. It is one thing to challenge one very, very close result in one place. It's another to start attacking the voting systems in two or three or four or five states. It's out of reach.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-hosts cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.
Jon, do you get a sense that Republicans outside of the Trump inner circle are detaching themselves, are cutting some frayed edges here and letting that lifeboat go out to sea?
No, really. I mean, you saw Jeb Bush congratulate Joe Biden, but that's hard. You know, that's hardly. I mean, he's no fan of the president. Mitt Romney congratulated the president elect. The interesting thing about Jeb Bush, just tangentially, is, of course, he's the son of a vanquished one-term president. So that's somewhat interesting. But no, you don't see it. And what strikes me is that, you know, let's allow for the news to sink in that Joe Biden is president-elect. And then let's allow for the idiosyncrasies of this individual president and the therapeutic exit ramp building that we just discussed. Okay. But Republicans who were either elected or reelected using this democratic process have an obligation at some point, real soon, maybe by the time people are listening to this, because when Donald Trump continues to say that Biden was elected by fraud, he's burning democratic furniture, as I said on air. I mean, he's playing with something really sensitive here, and he's telling his supporters that this is illegitimate. And Republican lawmakers have an obligation to say this is not so. And if they stand there and watch that and do nothing, that becomes the last act of standing there and watching something. They know better. They know better and are watching and doing nothing. And, you know, a lot of people would say that's what they did through the entire 4 years. And I don't think you want to go. I don't think you want to do that if you're a politician. But so far, that's what most of them are doing.
I mean, I hate to say it, but is that a rational calculus on their part? Since Trump was so strong with their base, he turned out their voters, his voters, in greater numbers than ever before?
The most rational calculation from a self-interested, not public good standpoint is to do the equivalent of I didn't see that tweet. To basically get really busy with your home improvement project and hope there's not a microphone near and just hope that the weight of events makes things pass along. Because you're 100% right. What's unique about this instance is that Donald Trump has lost, and yet his coalition is stronger than ever, and he turned out and did better with a lot of constituent groups than he did in 2016. You know, you remember a lot of people said in 2016, if only the media had told every voter every awful thing that Donald Trump had did. Well, there was no voter who didn't know the awful things that Donald Trump did, and they voted him into office anyway. In 2020, they had 4 years of the president doing things that a lot of people thought were awful, and they came out and voted for him in extraordinary numbers. So there is a lot of support for the president that's still out there. And if you're a Republican, you'd be an idiot not to pay attention to that. And so I'm just affirming everything you've said, Emily, which is, as a politically self-interested act, you want to pay attention to those voters. As a public good act and self-respect act for American democracy, you might want to do something else.
That's beautifully said, John. I want to make one little last point, and you guys may have other last points, but one of the things that was really striking down at the celebrations by the White House today were that there were repeatedly sort of spontaneous or generated chants that happened. And over again, there were chants for Stacey Abrams. That Stacey Abrams has emerged as a truly iconic figure in the Democratic Party. And her work registering voters in Georgia is clearly being appreciated and recognized. Emily, you obviously know Stacey Abrams and are friends with her, so you have a kind of a dog in the fight. But where do you think she goes with this?
Yeah, I mean, I think Stacey deserves all the accolades and the praise. There is a way in which the fact that she is not running for office makes her even more appealing because she appears to transcend politics right now. You know, I wonder if she was in one of those Senate races in Georgia, whether this would be more of a wave of Stacey Abrams appreciation or if it would sort of politicize her and then it would actually change. You know, I would bet that she will run for governor in 2 years in Georgia. Before then, she is someone whom I would think that the Biden team would be looking very closely at for a high-level position in Washington. And there is something about her star power as well as her talent and intelligence that just seems like you would want to grab a hold of it.
And where is the best place to deploy that is a really interesting question.
Yeah, I don't think I really have the answer to that. And I haven't asked her where she wants to be or anything like that. So I don't have any inside info.
I kind of feel like the two people who have really made their bones in these last weeks for different reasons. One is Stacey Abrams, who has been working devilishly hard for years and years on this incredibly important project. And the other, oddly, is Pete Buttigieg, who I think has emerged as an unbelievably effective commentator. And he will probably end up, I mean, I assume he'll end up with a talk show or something. But wow, he is... If I were Democrats, I'd be like, how can we get this guy speaking on our behalf as much as possible? Because he is so good.
Or in Washington. I mean, one thing that's important about both Buttigieg and Stacey is they're young. They're the next generation. And, you know, Biden in the beginning positioned himself as a kind of transitional figure, and including people who are in their 40s, who are, you know, really young, our age, or even younger than us.
I'm not in my 40s anymore.
It's going to be really important to bring those people in and make them part of what happens next, even more than people our age.
I mean, one of the things that will be interesting is that we are going to spend a lot of the time on future GabFests not talking about the president of the United States.
Oh, thank God.
I mean, think about the brain space that is going to be freed up. I mean, I'm remembering old phone numbers. I'm remembering memories from my youth. That's not kept up with the constant drama, because it's not just the drama, it's the pattern recognition is all thrown off. You know, you have a certain set of people, one person makes an argument, another person makes an argument, and then you kind of see who wins the best. And not everybody is acting in 100% good faith, but they're in the 90% good faith, and you kind of figure it out, and then you figure out what, you know, which argument won the day. We haven't had that for 4 years, mostly. It's been just mayhem of all kinds and different sorts. And some of the political questions of American life shouldn't be filtered through the presidency. And what I really hope is, and this is, Stacey Abrams makes me think of this because she obviously had a tremendous political effect on the presidency by the work she did in Georgia. But her, she represents to me action, and there's, and this is, there are ways in which this isn't, doesn't necessarily just have to be on the left, but action that exists outside of the kind of main obsession of the moment, which was constantly dictated by the unpredictability of the president.
All right, GabFest listeners, it's been a real pleasure talking to you today. It's it's been a good day for me. So we will
historic.
We will check in with you. I think we can. We won't be at the three GabFest a week schedule any longer. I think we're just going to get back to just doing one show a week, because that's about as much politics as anyone should have in their life. One GabFest worth a week. That is the show for today. The GabFest today is produced by June Thomas, our old beloved friend and colleague. Woof!
Thank you, June Thomas.
Thanks, June.
Yay, June.
Gabriel Roth is editorial director of Slate Podcasts. June Thomas is also the managing producer of Slate Podcasts, apparently. Alicia Montgomery is the executive producer of Slate Podcasts. You should follow us on Twitter at @SlateGabFest and tweet chatter to us there. For Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, I'm David Plotz. We will talk to you on Thursday.